This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
And a very good afternoon to you. This hour, we will try and find out who the winners might be after US President Donald Trump announced that the US will allow up to 300,000 tonnes of ground beef to be imported with zero tariffs. Will it be Australia or will it not? We'll find out shortly here on the Country Hour. Also today, taking a look at some of the rainfall figures over the weekend, I think some of you might have been pleasantly surprised by what you got in the gauge. In the Gascoyne, Bulati Station received 34 millimetres. In the Central West, 45 mils of rain. That was at Port Denison. And about 300 kilometres north of Perth in the Central Wheat Belt, Bunting received about 31 mils in the gauge. If you got some rain, was it forecast or was it just a nice surprise? And on the flip side, were the forecasts predicting you'd get some rain but you missed out? Text through. Let me know. Put your name, where you're texting from and how much rain you received. 0448 922 604. We'll cross to the Bureau just after 12:30 today and then Richard Hudson will go through the details of the rainfall figures over the weekend. 12:06 here on the Country Hour on the ABC WA. The inaugural Great Southern Farmer Awards were held near Denmark, about 400 kilometres southeast of Perth over the weekend. Farmers were nominated by their peers in five different categories. Stephen Piatsun is a market gardener from the region and believes a lot of hard work helped him win this year's Young Farmer of the Year.
I'm 29, so I've been doing it since I was 19.
You're growing vegetables, obviously.
Yeah, so I grow vegetables, cut flowers and raspberries.
What sort of acreage are you working off to get your produce off?
Relatively pretty small scale, so about 5 acres total, about 2 hectares. I can do that because we sell to the Albany Farmers Market, which means the farmer gets the whole dollar, so you don't need as much land.
What do you think made your application so special that the judges made you the winner?
I'm pretty involved in the community as well. A lot of people have helped me, like come and worked with me or supported me, and really, really care about what I do and the people I serve.
Congratulations, Stephen Piatsun, the Great Southern's Young Farmer of the Year. The winner of the Female Farmer of the Year award was presented to beekeeper Lisa Bone.
I have a business called The Little Hive out at Wellstead. So there's flavoured cream, tannies, medicinal honeys, raw honey, body products using beeswax and propolis, and also beeswax candles.
And how did you get into beekeeping?
It's kind of always been on my radar. As a little kid, I got stung on the hand, and ever since then I was called Lisa Lee the Bumblebee. And then when I moved back from Canada in 2020, Mum said, Lisa, I'm going to look after the kids. You're going to go to summer school and do the beekeeping course, because she had done it a couple of years earlier. And I was like, oh, awesome. I've always wanted to keep bees. So that started it. And then 15 hives came up for sale on the Bremer Road. And the little hive, it fit everything that I kind of was wanting to do. And so I bought the 15 hives and then moved them up to the farm, and here we are 4 years later, and I've got 22 hives, and it's going well.
Why do you think you were nominated? I know that's a difficult thing to answer, but you obviously stood out in the judges because of the business that you run.
I think probably because I do everything start to finish, and that's not really common. Like, you might just be the grain farmer that then sells to CBH, or the cow farmer that sells to the butcher, you know. So beekeeping, you can do from start to finish and put your label on it.
Beekeeper Lisa Bone, 12:09. Murray Gom from Arangi Wines won the Farm Innovation of the Year award, and he thinks it was his wife's vermouth that got them into the winner's circle.
Someone nominated myself and also my wife, Pam Lincoln, So it's the two of us that have been innovative. And as I said, I didn't fill out the form. Someone else did. But, yeah, I think, yeah, Pam having made vermouth, that was a real amazing thing to do, and that's been a great thing to do.
You're innovative by nature, aren't you? You're involved in regen farming as well?
Yeah, look, I've really taken that bull by the horns because it's just means we can do new things and try new things, and we can reduce inputs, we can produce really good food, we can recycle nutrients, we can improve our food. It's like, oh, there's so much stuff we can do here. It's so exciting. I've been running lots of workshops. I don't run the workshops. I get someone in to run the workshop so I can learn, and we invite other people, and other people come. They come to these workshops. So I think that was part of the reason that we're sort of become a little bit known for an education centre and come to learn, and let's share information and how do we do things a bit differently. So much innovation going on all over WA, all over Australia, all over the world, all over the Great Southern. There are people who are farming now, but a lot of people will be doing that in the future because they're getting results.
The Great Southern's Farm Innovation of the Year Award winner, Murray Gom. 11 past 12. Wine producers Melissa Bowie and her husband David Britton run Mumbaki Wines near Kent River and were stunned to be awarded the Agri-Tourism Farmer of the Year Award.
Honestly, we feel quite charmed and surprised that we were nominated. We're quite a small business. We started in the vineyards in 1997. It's very small. It's very hands-on. We've got a lovely north-facing gravelly hillside, so that captures the sun, and we can grow beautiful vines and get great wines that express the earth from that vineyard.
And were you interested in wine before you went down, or what was your experience that got you going with turning it into an agri-tourism business?
Yeah, well, it was a love of nature, the area, wanting to have like a country life to bring up our children. And David had some farming background in his family, so you felt quite comfortable.
My mum's family were dairy farmers before, so I spent a lot of my childhood back on the farm, and then I spent 5 years abroad, and then the dream was to, come back on the land again, which we did. And we've raised our three sons, grown up to be fine young men, so we felt we've done, the full circle. And we wanted something that would actually give us a living without having to go drive to Albany every day or go and work on the mine. So we wanted to actually make a living off our property. And we've only got 100 acres, so it was never enough to farm traditionally, which it was with cattle. We had to look to intensify, and we looked at putting in a vineyard and then moved on to making our wines. And we love what we do, and we really try and look after the land. We try and get involved with the community. So it's multifaceted. It's not just the business. It's the whole community is what it's all about.
There's obviously a lot of agritourism now, isn't it? It's become a very popular experience for people, especially from cities, to come. What do you think draws them to your place?
I think when you come to our place, you do get a unique experience. Like when they arrive at our, probably the smallest cellar door in the region, it used to actually be our carport, which then we decked out.
Look, we were rated for several years with a 5 red star rating from James Halliday. In our industry is a big deal, but for me, validation from our peers is probably worth a lot more. And I've always said, if you're good at what you do in any business or profession, being validated by people who do something similar, and I guess this award that we've got recognises a little bit of that.
Congratulations to wine producers Melissa Bowie and her husband David Britton, taking home the Agri-Tourism Farmer of the Year Awards at the inaugural Great Southern Farmer Awards over the weekend. Well, finally, the big gong, the Great Southern Farmer of the Year, went to Kevin Hard, who breeds Simmental cattle at his Narracoopa stud. He says he started the business small and likes to keep it that way.
We started off with one cow and a calf and a bull, which we purchased from Jim Jam Simmental stud in Pinjarra from the late Graham Lark. And that's basically where we started from. And then we expanded our stud and went to Williams and bought our first main stud sire from Williams, from Willander as they are now, and paid $7,800 for him. At the time, 30 years ago, was a lot of money for a bull.
And now you've decided to keep small too, haven't you?
That's right. The reason I've kept small is for two reasons. We haven't got a big area. I do run commercials as well, but I just feel that sometimes if you get too big, you've got too much to control and do it properly. And I just feel with the smaller numbers, I can be harder in my culling and control them better. That's all, yeah.
Now, your daughter nominated you.
That's right. My daughter apparently nominated me.
And why do you think she did that?
Well, I don't really know. I suppose she seems to think that Dad's done a reasonable job of farming, and she saw it advertised for Great Southern Farm of the Year. So she did it unbeknownst to me, and I don't know. Obviously, I don't have a clue what she put in the application form, but it must have been good.
Well, you've been farming for a very long time, so how does getting an award make you feel?
It's certainly an honour to get an award and be recognised. Obviously, when you start farming, you don't farm to get awards or get recognised or anything like that, but it is an honour to be recognised, and especially with, it's not only a Denmark thing, and as all different types of farmers that have been nominated for this award, and it is an honour to be recognised for what I've done in, as I say, I'm the wrong side of 70, but I still enjoy doing what I'm doing, and hopefully I've got a few more years left in me to do it.
Well done to Kevin Hard picking up the inaugural Great Southern Farmer of the Year Award. And he was speaking to the ABC's Mark Bennett, who emceed the event on the weekend. 17 past 12, Agriculture Minister Jackie Jarvis attended the inaugural awards and was so impressed she'd like to see other regions create their own farmer awards.
I would love to have some conversations about how we can expand it. It was really interesting. Early in the week, I was having a meeting with a few people, and someone, a CEO of a big agribusiness company, said, "We don't do enough to celebrate agriculture." And I sort of was reflecting on that. So, you know, this was community-led by volunteers last night. I would really like to think about what we can do to make it a wider, to have it in every region. Because, as I said, I think when I reflect on it, when I was talking to people, having people from all different types of farming in a room together, celebrating each other, but also, you know, learning off each other and going through the highs and lows of farming together, it was just a really uplifting event.
That's the Agriculture Minister, Jackie Jarvis, and just saying she'd like to see those Great Southern Farmer of the Year awards spread to other regions. There is the challenge for you. Perhaps that might inspire you to get your own region's farmer awards up and running for next year. 18 past 12.
You're part of the Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
WA's Education Minister says she understands parents at the Munglinup Primary School want a stable teaching staff, but has not committed to securing more permanent school housing for the town. Parents in the tiny community just off the south coast of WA, about 100 kilometres west of Esperance, have been calling for a second GROW house, or Government Regional Officer Housing, for almost a decade. On the weekend, a group of concerned parents lobbied the minister at the WA Council of State School Organisations, or WACSO, at the AGM in Perth. The minister, Sabina Winton, says having a consistent teaching staff can be challenging in regional Western Australia.
I know the Munglinup parent community have previously written to me, have had conversations with the Department of Education. So it was a really important opportunity for me to pull up a chair and have a conversation and listen to their perspective on what I'm hearing are the issues for them in Munglinup. And, you know, at the heart of their concerns really is making sure that we have stable teaching staff in that school. And I appreciate that's absolutely important for me too. That's what schools right around Western Australia want. We want excellent teachers in schools, but we also want stable staff, and that can be, for a variety of reasons, always more challenging in regional Western Australia.
Lots of communities are worried about the appropriateness of housing that's available for teachers. Now, obviously, it's a complex issue given the Department of Education doesn't manage GROW housing. What role does the Department of Education play in determining where these houses are placed and how appropriate they are for placing teachers in?
Yeah, and Nick, you're right. The overall responsibility of GROW housing, which for your listeners is the government housing for provides housing for some 5,500 properties right around the state. And interestingly, the Department of Education, of course, is a key client of the Department of Housing and Works, if you like. We have some 2,500 properties right around the state. And so the Department of Education works really closely with the Department of Housing and Works to make sure that the Department of Housing and Works understands our accommodation. By our, I mean the Department of Education's accommodation needs, and make sure that we work collectively to make sure that we continue to build and to lease new properties in line with the needs of the Department of Education. So it's a very close, good working relationship.
WA Minister for Education, Sabina Winton. 21 past 12. Kelly Bell was one of the parents who met with Minister Winton, and she says she came out of the meeting feeling like the housing situation for teachers at the Munglinup School is unlikely to change.
It was great for her to hear our issues. However, I don't feel it achieved much in a sense of further GROW housing in these smaller towns. She seemed happy with the current situations. And of course, they cite all the budget, and that because we've got some current housing for them, that we can just continue as is without having these long-term, stable and local houses for our staff.
That doesn't sound like an overly satisfying resolution to that conversation.
No, definitely not. She promised she would go away and they would look into it further. Look, even if it doesn't help our town as such, it's great that we keep pushing the general lack of housing issue to her, so that some of the towns even worse off than us may qualify for another house. We're struggling to retain consistent long-term teachers in the regions. Like, my daughter's had 5 teachers this year already, and last year we had a full staff. Leading into this year, we've had a full staff turnover, and some of those teachers left because of housing reasons. So, yeah, we're just looking out for the future of our children. I've still got 3 young children. One of them hasn't even started school yet, and I'm nervous for how many teachers he will go through one day.
Do you feel you've achieved what you set out to achieve today?
I think so. I've already had quite a few people I don't know have come up and congratulated me and said, well done on your raising awareness for your issue. I think people are just unaware. So I'm really happy we brought some awareness to the issue, and then also hearing from other rural delegates saying, oh, me too, we've got this issue. So it'd just be nice for it to be given a little bit more thought, I suppose, by the government, to realise that we need this long-term investing in the regions. Like, none of us are going anywhere. Yes, we are small schools, but we are there for the long run. We need to keep quality teachers for the long term.
And so what's next for the parents of Munglinup in terms of advocating for this change in GROW housing?
So we had a motion passed today at the WACSO conference that the WACSO council will take on some advocating on our behalf. We've also been in talks with ICPA, which is the Isolated Children's Parents Association, to bring awareness to the issue. And at a local level, we've all been writing letters, emails to all the relevant ministers and departments, just trying to be persistent that, you know, this issue is not going anywhere, but we're also not going anywhere. Yeah, that's probably where we're at.
Munglinup parent Kelly Bell speaking to Nicholas Ward and following up on Tara de Langraaf's story that you heard on Friday's Country Hour. 24 past 12. US President Donald Trump is saying that he has struck a deal to, and I quote, substantially lower the price of ground beef for working American families. President Trump says the US will allow up to 300,000 tonnes of ground beef to be imported with 0 tariffs, and a commitment that this beef will be sold at 25% below current market prices.
Meat market analyst Simon Quilty says at this stage the announcement and plan lacks detail, but he thinks Brazil's cattle industry might be the only winner.
As of Friday, President Trump announced that there would be a 90-day waiver on out-of-quota tariffs for grinding meat going into America and 300,000 metric tons of it. So the idea being that that influx would lower the value of ground beef in North America. I think that Brazil is the only winner out of this. And even then, it's probably questionable how much they'll put in. But of all the other import countries, whether it's Australia, Uruguay, Argentina, New Zealand, we're all sitting at about 70 to 75% of our allocation. And so there's really no upside for us or all those countries. It's really those that are currently out of access or paying the duty of 26.4%, which is Brazil and Japan.
Because Australian beef going into the US at the moment is going in tariff-free already, isn't it?
It is going in. You know, we're at about 75% of our allocation, and I would imagine at the pace we're going, Matt, that we would have been able to see the year out without any difficulty. So this reduction will have little to no influence on Australian beef value. What it does is, the concern is, lowers the overall price within the US market and therefore lowers Australia's beef export prices due to, you know, to a saturation of that lean meat market in America.
Mm. Under this deal, President Trump says this imported beef must be sold at 25% below the current market price. How's that going to happen?
That's a very good question. There is no detail given whatsoever, Matt. So it's difficult to know how they would monitor that and enforce it as well. What's interesting to note is that the next 3 months is actually a low demand period in America. So I think they could have achieved this outcome without any need of touching or lowering tariffs.
I've got some audio here from the US Secretary of Agriculture, Brooke Rollins. This is her speaking to Fox Business and essentially blaming record high beef prices in America at the moment, blaming it on the former administration.
Listen, what we are facing in America today is the direct result of a war on cattle by the previous administration, frankly, a war on agriculture and a war on farming in general. When you've got a prior administration that is basically blaming cattle for their crazy climate agenda, then you have a real problem. And you also have, you combine that with, people are eating more beef today than ever before, which is actually really, really good news. Secretary Kennedy and I obviously have been working on new dietary guidelines. We have big announcements coming up on new school lunches. And eating real food is right in the middle of all of that. And so while we're working on combining all of this, ensuring that our ranchers have what they need to continue to rebuild their herds. But listen, here's the good news. For the first time since 2018, we're now seeing a turn where the cattle numbers are now moving back up, where ranchers are retaining their heifers, their mama cows, how they breed their heifers, mm-hmm. are retaining at a higher rate than they have now in years. So I think the administration, President Trump's focus on our ranchers, on rural America, on rebuilding our food supply here continues to be a priority, and our ranchers are getting that message.
So that's the U.S. Secretary of Ag, Brooke Rollins. A lot in that piece of audio, Simon Quilty, but I did want to pick up on the comment. The Secretary says it's the first time since 2018 that cattle numbers in the U.S. are moving back up. Does that match with the data you've seen about the herd?
Not really, Matt. I mean, it's pretty subdued, the situation. We saw in the latest inventory figures where there was a reduction in, you know, the cow numbers by about 2.5%, but the heifer numbers had increased. And so when you netted them out, overall female numbers were still down. So I don't agree with that. I also don't agree about, you know, saying that this was driven by the Biden administration, because they invested over $1 billion in processing capacity in America post-COVID. But the clear message from Friday's cattle on feed report is the supply is going to be extremely tight going forward. So all the indications are that the rebuild is still yet to really begin.
The National Cattlemen's Beef Association, which is sort of the peak lobby group over in the US for all things beef, it says no cow-calf producer in America is asking for increased imports and that this is undercutting American farmers. How much pressure do you think this announcement by the president's going to come under from that US cattle industry?
I think it's enormous, Matt, and you just have to look across, you know, social media over the last 48 hours. And I think there's real truth to it is that by lowering this tariff and having an influx of Brazilian beef, it is detrimental to overall cattle prices in America. And what they need is higher prices to incentivize retention of females, not lower prices. So the argument being is that this prolongs the problem by lowering tariffs, and therefore the rebuild takes longer. So I think there's a strong argument to say that in actual fact, this policy decision will achieve the opposite.
Meat market analyst Simon Quilty from Global AgriTrends speaking to Matt Brown about the recent beef announcements made by the US President Donald Trump. 29-1, Jonathan Hopper is here with the news headlines.
Good afternoon, Belinda. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has declared there will be no change to WA's GST arrangements. Earlier this month, the Productivity Commission released its interim report into the 2018 GST deal, calling it a costly mistake and recommending the federal government scrap it. On his first visit to WA since the release of the interim report, Mr. Albanese said there will be no change to the 2018 deal because WA deserves it. The Pakistani Chief of Defence Forces travels to Iran today to try to reopen negotiations between Tehran and the United States. The trip comes as Washington prepares to unveil more economic sanctions against Iran, which are expected to punish countries which do business with Tehran. Iran, in turn, has vowed to shut down all oil exports from the Gulf. And a British collector who chanced upon a rare Tasmanian tiger's mounted head at an auction says experts have now verified it as genuine. The specimen was listed as a fox head but was purchased by oddity shop owner James Cranfield for £62,000. Thank you, Belinda.
Jonathan, thank you so much for that update. It's 28-1.
You're with Belinda Varaschetti on the Country Hour on ABC Local Radio WA.
Between now and the news at 1 o'clock, we'll go through the results of the Fitzroy Bull Sale that was held on Friday. We touched on it on Friday's Country Hour, but we'll go through the prices for you shortly. And we'll also head to Mushay for the results of the cattle market, today's cattle market there. Terry Birkin will have the details. And also, a WA Masters research student has set up a business that adds value to all sorts of agricultural and food waste. So what's it turned into? We will find out shortly. First, to the Bureau of Meteorology, Bob Tarr is with us today. And Bob, what's it like across northern and eastern parts of WA?
Yeah, over the north, we just have a ridge of high pressure in place. So a lot of east to northeasterly winds through many areas, lighter winds over the northern part of the Kimberley. But that ridge will be around for the next day or two. And then over western parts of the Pilbara, it'll start to break down later tomorrow, and then gradually from west to east as we go forward to Wednesday and Thursday, that ridge weakens. Over northern parts of the Kimberley, we could see very isolated afternoon showers, and then some moisture may get drawn down from the north ahead of a trough on Thursday, so there's a slight chance that we could even see some showers around Broome and then adjacent inland parts from there on Thursday before that all moves away, and then we're just left with a new ridge of high pressure. Over the interior, we are going to have some showers and thunderstorms developing from around Thursday, and then those will contract away to the east. So might see some decent falls on Thursday from showers and storms, but all in all, fairly dry week for most areas, as you'd often expect this time of year.
And Bob, into the Southwest Land Division, it does look like there might be some rain for some parts, sort of midweekish.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the really main feature that we're looking at on the weather map over the next several days, is that cold front that starts pushing into the southwest during later tomorrow, and then it becomes pretty slow moving, so it takes its time moving inland. But we'll start with today, not really much happening, just some late showers along the southwest coast, and then fairly cold tonight, so some inland parts anywhere from about 1 to 5 degrees for a min tonight. Then that cold front pushes in, start seeing some showers developing about the southwest capes later tomorrow, and then that front finally moves in on sort of Tuesday night and Wednesday. It doesn't really reach the Perth area until later in the day on Wednesday. So it is a quite slow-moving feature, and because it is slow-moving, there is a potential that we could see some fairly heavy rainfall, especially around that area, Geograph Bay, up through about Mandurah Harvey, and then adjacent inland parts. So those places there, and then the residual showers into Thursday, likely to see some falls up around the 30 to 60 mil mark, and wouldn't be rule out some falls up around the 80 to 100 mils. So that'd be in very isolated circumstances where you get the training of showers and thunderstorms coming right in off the water. And as we go further to the north, the falls will be dropping off from that. Across the period from Wednesday, or so, I should say later Tuesday out to Thursday, we're probably looking at falls. The lightest falls across the main agricultural areas will be over inland parts of the Midwest, so places like Morawa, Mullowa, probably only a few mils there. Across northern parts of the Wheat Belt, not going to see all that much rainfall, probably about 3 to 10 mils from Meriden on northward up through Beacon. And then as you get further south from Meriden, there's a bit of uncertainty in terms of the rainfall, but especially when you get south of about Corrigan, down towards Kojonup, they're probably going to do fairly well, as there is going to be a low-pressure system that may develop within this front. And so especially on Wednesday night and Thursday, we could be looking at some pretty decent rain from Kojonup right across to the Esperance region. And some of those areas could see anywhere from about 15 to 50 mils. Again, fairly uncertain as far as the rainfall, but it does look like for the main ag areas, the Great Southern and across to Esperance is probably going to do the best from this system. And then we'll see the rain lingering around the Esperance region. Could see anywhere from about 2 to 10 mils on Friday, whereas western areas up through the Wheat Belt and the Midwest will be drying out, and it looks like pretty dry weather over the weekend with a new ridge of high pressure. So yeah, definitely across the next week, it's really that Wednesday, Thursday feature that's going to bring the vast majority of our rainfall.
Thank you so much for that, Bob. I hope that brings some joy to some who really need it. Let's continue that look at the rainfall and have a look back over the weekend. Richard Hudson has the details for you.
Yeah, so these figures are from 9 o'clock in the morning on Friday through to 9 a.m. today. Nothing really recorded in the Kimberley or the Pilbara, nothing of note. In the Gascoyne, some good rain, though. Bulardi Station had 34, Bulga Downs 8, Kerry Downs 16, Coodardie 14, Kew 10, Gascoyne Junction 9, Meekatharra 15, Mingar Springs 5, Mount Gibson 13, Mount Narrier 20, Murchison 25, Mergoo 15, Payne's Find 6, Shark Bay 45, Steep Point 35, Three Rivers 6, and Winyangu, I think is how you pronounce it, 10. That's a newie for me. In the interior, Carnegie had 13 and Warburton 12. And then in the goldfields, Boulong 5, Credo 6, Edgardina 14, Kalgoorlie Boulder and Leinster both had 5, Laverton 7, Leonora 6. In the Eucla district, Eucla itself had 14 and Forrest 7. Nothing recorded on the islands. And in the Southwest Land Division, it was very hit and miss to do with the areas. If you're in the central west, there was a bit around. Alanuki and Berkshire Valley had 8, Barberton East 32, Bindi Bindi 14, Balgarda 11, Canterbury 38, Chapman Valley 7, Karoo 15, Eridu 11, Greengrove 10, Latham 12, Mindala 27, Mingenew 8, Moascar 6, Nabawar 11, New Norcia 13, Perenjori 8, Port Denison 45, Tabletop 11, Three Springs 5, Tibraden 12, and Tardon Hill and Una both recorded 9. Then in the Lower West, Bindoon 5, Bolgart Bin and Dwelling Up 6, Gidgegan Up 7, Julimar Forest 12, Carrigulla North 5, Lake Chittering and Millenden both recorded 6, Mouchet 5, and we'll have the cattle report towards the end of the show, New Nile 12, Pierce at the RAF Base 8, Pinjarra 6, Rollystone 18, Tamala Park 10, 2J East 9, and Watning and Whiteman Park both recorded 7. In the southwest and southern coastal regions, there was nothing really over 3 mils, and a few places had sort of 2s and 1s, and that's about it. But in the central wheat belt, there was a fair bit more. Amory Acres 10, Ballardew 22, Beacon 16, Ben Cubbin 7, Bonnie Doon 18, Bonnie Rock 17, Bullfinch 13, Bunting West 31, Burrakin 10, Burrakoppin South and Cadoo recorded 6, Codgecodgeon 7, Cowcowing 22, Dalwallinu and East Beverley recorded 9, Ajanding 11, Gabbin 17, Goodlands and Happy Valley 10 mils, Gamaling, Killanny, Kellerberrin North, Long Forest and Meriden all recorded 5, Juradine 21, Cocodine 19, Condit 30, Corder 20, Monongarran 6, Muckenbooden 12, Muresk 6, Northam 7, Southern Cross 5, Training West 15, Westonia 14, Wyalke 24, Wongan Hills 19, and York East and Yorkrakine both recorded 8. And then in the Great Southern area, Quartering recorded 5 mils. Corrigan had the same, but that was over 5 days. Wandering had 7 and Wilgarra had 5 mils.
Richard, thank you very much for that. 18 minutes to 1 o'clock. To the southwest of the state now, where the owners of a small avocado and tourism business believe they've lost most of their farm equipment in a fire on Saturday afternoon. Leah Williams and her partner own and run the Carey Glade Farm Stay near Manjimup. She says the accidental electrical fire in their shed has caused about $200,000 worth of damage.
Unfortunately, while we were at the Balling Up Festivals, we got a message from our guests telling us that our shed was on fire. And thankfully, all of our neighbours acted really quickly and they got the fire brigade out here. Unfortunately, nothing could be saved because it was an electrical fire, and they had to wait for Western Power to come here and disconnect the power. So at the moment, we're running off generators and only using basic power.
Yeah.
But we're really grateful that we've got such lovely neighbours and a local community that have reached out to help us kind of keep going.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. And do you have a, I mean, how much, you're saying before we turn the tape on that it's, you've lost quite a lot of equipment.
Yeah, so we've lost a lot of our equipment that we use for harvesting avocados and the general maintenance of the farm. So my husband, he's actually an electrician, but he's lost all of his Sparky equipment. So he's a Sparky without a tool at the moment. So, yeah, we're just going to slowly work towards replacing the things that we need first. Mm. We're about to make a little surprise trip into Busselton tomorrow to pick up some chainsaws and equipment so we can continue harvesting our avocados and selling them to the local community.
Sure. And you're saying about $200,000, you think you've put the cost at and you're still seeing if insurance can cover it.
Yeah, unfortunately, I discovered a clause in our insurance that looks like our shed may not be covered, but we're hoping that our home contents might help to pay for some of the things. We're very lucky in that we were about to decommission that shed and we actually do have another shed being built at the moment. The slab's due to go down once the rain kind of halts back and they can get a few dry days. So we do have a new shed on the way, but unfortunately, we're going to have to replace all the equipment. I mean, we are bringing avocados to 10 suburbs in Perth, so we're just trying to get rid of them up there and hopefully raise a bit of money to kind of replace the things we need to keep going. And then we've obviously got our accommodation too. And we've just spent today trying to dig up power lines and connect some generators. So Yeah, we've got basic power. Everyone's alive and no one's hurt. So that's I'm really grateful for that. I'm also very grateful that this didn't happen in summer, because that would have been really frightening if that did.
Leah Williams from Carriglad Farmstay near Manjimup, which has an avocado farm and a couple of chalets. She was speaking to Georgia Lonely about a fire on their property around about 4 o'clock on Saturday afternoon. Volunteer firefighters took nearly 2 hours to put out the blaze, and DFES says the cause of the fire was accidental. 16-1. More than 100 bulls were trucked across the country from Queensland to the Kimberley for the 20th annual Fitzroy Crossing Bull Sale on Friday. Elders State Livestock Manager Michael Longford travelled up from Bunbury for the sale. He says all the bulls on offer were sold and the average price was up $1,700 on last year, which shows there's high confidence in the industry.
It was an excellent sale. The atmosphere was fantastic. And I think being the 20th year, bit of a milestone for it as well, which is also fantastic. Top price was $13,000. The average this year was just over $7,000 compared to last year, which was just over $5,300. So basically we're up $1,700 on this year's sale, which is absolutely fantastic.
And in terms of buyers, who did you have at the sale today, as well as people online, because there is that option to bid online as well?
Yes, yeah. So we have Auctions Plus here, which is really good, and there was a little bit of activity online. Unfortunately, this year, Auctions Plus didn't buy any bulls. The actual people that were bidding this year, very similar people turn up every year. And this year, the season's up this way has been reasonable again this year. That also helps along, but yeah, they're just very strong on all the bulls this year. There's a lot of activity on the majority of the bulls and pretty fierce activity, nice bidding, and that kept their auctioneer and our clerks very active, which is good.
And what is it that buyers seem to be looking for this year? Were there certain breeds or types of bulls that got more attention?
It's hard to say when you have a sale that the clearance is 100%. All the bulls got their fair share of bidding on them. Obviously, the Brahmins and the Red Brahmins always do very well up this way due to the markets. But, yeah, all the other breeds that were in here as well did exceptionally well, like your Droughtmasters, your Queenslanders and your Simbras, yeah, your Charbrays. They all sold extremely well this year and plenty of activity on them.
Was there anything that surprised you about today's results?
Well, I was very surprised on the average. Like the average being up $1,700 on last year, I reckon, is a fantastic effort by everybody. This shows you the demand that's out there and the confidence in the industry. The atmosphere has been fantastic here since we turned up on the Wednesday right through till today and still going. It's just a really great atmosphere, and people are all very friendly, all very talkative. They just run a really good show up here, everybody. A really good congratulations to every one of them for doing this for 20-odd years, and they keep coming back.
Elders State Livestock Manager for WA, Michael Longford, speaking after the 20th annual Fitzroy Crossing Bull Sale on Friday. He was speaking to Jess Baker. All 120 bulls on offer this year were from Queensland. 12-1. A WA Masters research student has set up a business that adds value to all sorts of agricultural and food waste. Lin Liu says she was busy working as an associate researcher at Curtin University when she realised there was an opportunity to branch out into private enterprise.
So since I started this work, I started out with abalone products. So you could use the viscera, which is, the guts. You can use that for nutraceuticals. You could use it for pet food. With horticultural products, it's a little bit broader. There's obviously food for human consumption. And then there's also the extraction of polyphenols and antioxidants, things like that. So nutraceutical and pharmaceutical use. But we're also seeing that just through fermentation, you can actually turn these products into, obviously alcohol because of the high sugar content. But I'm also working with someone who can actually turn fruit waste into lab-grown wood, which is incredible, within 21 days, just through precision fermentation. He's just extracting the pure cellulose and fibre. So it's pretty incredible the things that we can do with food.
Where did the interest in waste and, I guess, the opportunities within waste come from for you?
For me, it's the problem-solving element, and I just like seeing everything used. Like, in my own personal life, drives my husband absolutely mental. But yeah, in my own personal life, but I think it just makes so much sense as a business move too. Like if you can, particularly for growers, if you can use 100% of what you're producing, you're using everything that you're growing. It costs the same to grow a first grade apple as it does a second grade or a processing grade apple, you know, so there are sunk costs there. And then if you're utilising everything, you're also realising those opportunity costs of, you know, something you might have not been able to sell previously. If you can value add to it or find some way of using it beneficially within the business, like composting or enriched composting or something like that, it just makes so much sense for the business from a financial standpoint too.
And have people been receptive? I mean, how have you tackled this? Have you approached it from the farming end or have you approached it more from the product end or both?
So initially much more from the grower end and also with food and beverage manufacturers being really interested in exploring opportunities to use all their byproducts. But I think the longer I've done this work, the more obvious it is that you really have to tackle it from both ends. You have to have a customer and a market that is willing to pay for whatever it is you're producing, if it's a new product that you're developing. But obviously, if it's a more circular sort of in-house solution, for example, like rapid composting, you know, then obviously there's no customer base there and it just has to make sense for your business. Mm. But it's been very much increasingly grower-led and food and beverage manufacturing-led. When we do look at new product development, we look at things that can be reliably marketed. So, for example, nutrition sort of claims. You know, if something is grown with in a particular region or with particular growing techniques and that contributes to, for example, a piece of fruit that has more nutritional quality in some way, you know, it might have more protein or, I mean, probably not for fruit, but it might have more fiber or it might have, you know, higher sugar content, you know, which obviously helps for flavour, might have more polyphenol content, something like that. I think those are things that really help with new product development and for marketing products that might be made from rescued produce. But I don't think the consumer necessarily has to know that it's made from rescued produce, if that makes sense. So, yeah.
It's a rapidly changing world at the moment, but there has become a glaring story that we do have a significant issue with our input reliability and our input costs. Do you think that makes what you're doing even more relevant in coming years, because we do have to make every single aspect of our horticulture, our commodities go to use?
100%. Yeah, I really do think that, yeah, the challenges that growers are having at the moment with even with compliance costs, actually, I think these are all really good drivers or motivators for growers finding ways of increasing use of all of what they produce. And that's what we're hearing from growers all the time, is that, oh, we should have done this probably 10 years ago, but we're just getting to it now. And I think that really points to some of the work that I'm doing with some of the businesses that can provide these solutions for waste processing or value adding. The most important thing is that whatever solution we propose to growers has to return a benefit to them in the short term and not the long term, because these issues are so pressing now. Like, they are urgent issues that need to be addressed in the near term. And that's why I think it's really positive that lots of these, I'm going to call them waste solutions providers, they're developing more innovative models that actually focus on benefit sharing with growers. And I think that's really important for addressing the drivers of why would I implement this change now, and how's it going to benefit my business, and how is it going to alleviate some of those pressures that I'm feeling with compliance costs, input costs, you know, shortage of labour, even extreme climactic events. So, you know, we've just had a heat wave and two cyclones go through Carnarvon, and, you know, obviously with that, value adding isn't the first priority, but you know, some very motivated growers still are very focused on value-adding and powering through with it anyway, because they realise what payoff it can have for them in the short term.
UpWaste founder Lynn Liu speaking to Christy O'Brien, and she featured on a waste story that was on yesterday's Landline TV show. If you'd like to watch it, just search ABC Landline and you'll find it. And you can also watch it on iView. 6 to 1. You heard Lynn Liu saying that she's working with someone who's turning fruit waste into lab-grown wood. That person is scientist Matt Barber, who is an environmentalist with a passion project that's still in the proof of concept stage. He's using precision fermentation to turn fruit and brewing waste into cellulose that could be used for all sorts of products.
As we all know, humans use a lot of land. So whether it's to grow our food, the fibres or the textiles for our shirts, the meat or whatever it is, we use a lot of land to grow the materials we need. And this is just focusing on that and trying to use less resources to get the materials that we need, which we are all doing anyways. Over time, we're using far less land to grow our materials and food. But this is a way I see of doing it quicker.
Is it cost prohibitive to do that, or is that isn't the issue yet?
Yes, currently it's quite cost prohibitive, as everything's done manually, depending on the waste material we get as well. So if it's fruit waste, you still have to process that, you have to blend it, you have to add enzymes, you have to it takes a whole day just to do a batch. So it's very small, and then all of it's manually done, so I pull it out of its containers, I have to wash it still. So that's this phase. The next phase is semi-autonomous, which is the new reactor, which I am actually working on, and then hopefully when that works, get to the new level, and then, yeah, it's just kind of a stage like that, and then the cost comes down with that. So, yeah, it's quite a long-term thing, so I'm thinking more 2035 timeline. So at the moment it works off food waste, but the long-term game is to actually get it growing off of an energy source, which is carbon dioxide, a bigger waste system, which is possible now, but cost prohibitive, even more than food waste.
And in regards to what waste you use, does it matter, or is it quite specific food waste you have to use?
Yeah, so fruit waste is pretty good. High in sugars, you don't have to process it as much because the sugars are quite simple. And then what I use quite a lot of is actually brewer's waste and distillery waste, which is high in alcohol, which the bacteria like. So it likes alcohol, likes a bit of acidity, and then sugars.
And the product itself you're shooting out?
So what I get is pure cellulose that comes out. And then from there, I process that into either paper, leather, or wood products. But it could be turned into a bioplastic. It can be turned into any uses. It's just basically finding a market and then going with that. But it's hard starting with something more quite expensive into bioplastics.
Matt Barber, the founder of a new material company called Brew Tree, which is trying to turn waste into cellulose products. He was speaking to Christy O'Brien. 3 to 1, let's get to the market now. And cattle numbers were down a little at today's Mouchet sale. The final tally was 757, so that's down 369 on last week. Terry Birkin has the details. Hi, Terry.
Hi, Belinda. Today's sale offered a conservative yarding with most categories reasonably represented. The buying field was attended by a healthy cross-section of processors, feedlot buyers and restockers. Most steer and heifer categories were firm to slightly dearer, while pastoral numbers were much lighter, and while quality and pricing didn't reach last week's highs, comparatively values remained equal. The cow market remained firm, while young bulls eased significantly with live export demand falling away. Local weaner steers were selling from 320 cents to 574 cents, while weaner heifer started from 300 cents and sold up to 494 cents a kilo. Local yearling steers weighing under 400 kilos returned 366 to 526 cents and heavier weights from 472 to 516 cents a kilo. Yearling heifers under 400 kilos were selling from 350 to 472 cents and with more weight and frame sold from 400 cents to 482 cents. Pastoral steer calves and yearlings ranged from 300 cents to 416 cents, while pastoral heifer calves made 200 cents to 442 cents, and yearlings from 250 to 386 cents a kilo. Grown steers returned 314 cents to 480 cents, while grown heifers returned 340 to 470 cents. Like frame pastoral store cows sold from 100 cents to 246 cents, while bigger frame local store cows made 250 to 330 cents a kilo. Medium weight cows sold to 344 cents and heavy cows realised 360 cents. As demand fell away from live export, young bulls eased 60 to 80 cents and ranged from 180 cents to 392 cents, while heavy pastoral bulls sold from 270 cents to 340 cents and the few local bulls yarded gained 10 to 15 cents, selling from 324 to 352 cents a kilo. This is Terry Birkin for MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you, Terry. Just before the news, wanted to let you know that WAMIA has a new chair. Now, WAMIA is the WA Meat Industry Authority, and the new chair of the board is Louise Holding, who's previously had leadership roles with the Mindaroo Foundation and the Harvest Road Group. She's also been Chief of Staff to the Environment Minister. State Agriculture Minister Jackie Jarvis made the announcement and says Louise Holding has been appointed for the next 3 years. Good to talk to you today. Time for the news, 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.